Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on freedom of speech when we come back. You know, during World War II, our parents and grandparents planted victory gardens, and they helped to provide their own food and fiber for themselves and for their country. Today, over half the food that we eat in this country is imported from outside our borders. And our food is produced from hybrid seed that will not reproduce, and it is nutritionally deficient. Now, Adolf Steinbrom of Fairbanks, Iowa, put the matter in perspective by having samples of corn tested for nutrients that are usually added to commercial feeds. Now, when compared to more than 4,000 samples of hybrid corn tested in 10 Midwest states in a recent year, Steinbrom's open-pollinated corn contained 75% more crude protein, 875% more copper, 345% more iron, and 205% more manganese. And the same result has also been seen in the content of calcium, sodium, magnesium, and zinc. Now, in the opinion of many ecologic farmers, hybrid seed merely masks poor farming practices by producing bins and bushels of foodless food without the nutrients that are really food's reason for being in the first place. Now, if you'd like to know more about this multinational corporate monopoly of our seed and food supplies and how you can become independent from them, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free. And you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click on the email machine and send an email request for your free General Law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do that right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. All right, freedom of speech. Everybody believes in freedom of speech. Everybody believes that he has a right to spout off and say what he wants to say about whoever he wants to say it about, to whoever he wants to say it to, and whenever he wants to say it, period. Here in the United States, traditionally, we have valued this thing of freedom of speech. We've enshrined it in our Constitution and in our Bill of Rights in the First Amendment. We like to look at radio and television and the newspapers and the media as having the right to freedom of speech. You know, we like to be free to talk. But that's what we spout off about. We actually don't practice that here. Well, you better not practice it, because if you do, you're going to be ostracized. You're going to be looked upon as some kind of a nut. And around the world, it's even worse. I would suspect that here in the United States, we probably have a greater array of opportunity to practice freedom of speech than, say, in Germany, where you have hate crimes. Hate crimes? There's a movement going around. There's a thing that we call historical revision. He's one of those historical revisionists. And there are groups around the world that don't like historical revision. Well, hell, nobody likes historical revision when that historical revision names them. You know, if you told the truth about George Gordon, I would be opposed to your interpretation or your historical revision. But when I'm talking about you or your group, you know, if I want to talk about Germans, or I want to talk about Frenchmen or somebody else, that's fair game, but don't you talk about me. So we really don't like the truth unless it's the truth about somebody else. We don't like the truth as it relates to us. And, you know, that's where freedom of speech really runs into a lot of trouble. And I thought, well, let's talk about freedom of speech, because last week we took a look at destroyed arguments from Larry Beecraft. And in this destroyed arguments, Larry Beecraft points to George Gordon on two issues and says that I'm crazy. Well, he doesn't name me personally and say that George Gordon's crazy, but he uses the word crazy in two of his articles. Now, he's got 26 subject matters that he covers in destroyed arguments. And I have that destroyed arguments in part of my paperwork. And many times my students, after they have read destroyed arguments, come back and say, I don't understand why you would use this destroyed arguments and put it in your paperwork and promote this guy Larry Beecraft when he runs you down. And I thought about that for a minute, and I said, well, I don't think Larry Beecraft is running me down. I never thought that he was or did. Now, it is true that there are two articles in here out of 26 that he takes a different approach or a different view, a different belief than I do. But I've never ran or tried to run Larry Becraft down and said, well, wait a minute, he's crazy because he holds this view. I've never said Catholics are all stupid because they disagree with George Gordon or I disagree with them. I know from time to time people will say, well, that guy Gordon's anti-Semitic, and I dissent from that opinion. I'm not anti-Semitic. I've been called anti-government, anti-tax, and anti-this and anti-that. And I don't subscribe to that. I'm not anti-abortion. I am pro-life. But because I'm pro-life does not mean that I'm anti-abortion. And because I'm not a Christian does not mean that I'm anti-Christian. Hell, I'm not a Muslim either, but that doesn't make me anti-Muslim. Now, the other day, Barack Obama, our president, he said that we were not anti-Muslim. Well, the fact that we're fighting two wars in two Muslim countries over there, he says that doesn't make us anti-Muslim. Now, if you're a Muslim and you're living over there in the Middle East and you see the United States of America with armed troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, which are two Muslim countries, you might come to the conclusion that Americans are anti-Muslim. I don't think that's true. So isn't that a matter of perspective? Isn't that the way you see it, irrespective of the way we see it? You know, I just wanted to point out that other people have different viewpoints than I do, and I don't see them as necessarily being anti-Gordon. I think that freedom of speech should encompass a very broad array of subjects and subject matter. Now, the courts have ruled on this a time or two. They've said, look, you don't have a right to cry out fire, fire in a crowded theater. And you don't have a right to slander or libel somebody. And so we have a definition here for libel and slander. And then we have clear and present danger. You know, if you were in a crowded theater and you were to cry out fire and people believed you and they jumped up and ran for the exits, you know, you could have some injuries. You could have some people killed. That happens once in a while. Now, if there's a real fire, should we then shut up and not cry out fire, fire? And so what we do is we have to temper that with the circumstances. You know, if somebody sees that there's a fire, I guess we should cry out fire, fire. Maybe the people that are going to pile up and get injured getting out of the building is a small price to pay for saving your life, from saving you from being burned to death. And I haven't seen anybody prosecuted for crying fire, fire. If there was a real fire and some people were injured in the process of escaping, and that'd be an interesting thought, you know, an interesting litigation. You know, how would the courts rule? So I thought I would take one of Larry Becraft's articles. It's kind of a long article, so I thought I'd take some time, effort, and energy, and we'll take a look at freedom of speech, free speech. And then we'll analyze that, and we'll see, well, do we have a lot that we agree on? Do we have some points of general agreement that we disagree on? You know, you could say, well, I'm in favor of this bailout program, but I'm opposed to the way it's being carried out. Another guy might come along and say, well, I'm opposed to this bailout program, period. I'm in favor of bankruptcy. Another guy might come along and say, well, I'm opposed to both the bankruptcy approach and I'm opposed to the bailout approach, and here's my approach and here's what I think. Would this make them right-wing radicals or anti-Semitic or anti-this or that, anti-government or tax protesters or, you know, some other negative connotation because they disagree with your approach? Don't other people have a right to their opinions? Don't other people have a right to think? Don't other people have a right to express their views just because they disagree with you? Don't you think that maybe they ought to have a right to express themselves? Or do you believe that I'm the only guy here that has a right to express himself and the rest of you guys stifle yourselves? So let's take a look at this concept of freedom of speech. It's kind of a wild new idea. When our founding fathers came up with this and enshrined it in our Constitution, it runs in the face of people like Adolf Hitler and Joe Stalin, who didn't like criticism. They didn't want somebody pointing the finger at them and saying, hey, it's what you're doing, and we disagree with your policy or we disagree with you. And so in totalitarian countries, they stifle freedom of speech, very common, you know, for freedom of speech, you know, is distinguished now from freedom of action. I mean, you have a right to think, you have a right to speak, but not everywhere. And for instance, I want to bring one of these up here. This is called this historical revisionism. There's a belief out here that the Nazi concentration camps didn't gas those Jews, that's a fiction, that that's not true. And this is called historical revisionism. So several countries, first of all, the Jews are opposed to it. Oh, they're just livid, really ticked off. And then certain countries, Canada and Germany are two that have passed laws now making it a crime. If I were in Canada and I said, I think that these claims that the Nazis killed these Jews by gassing them to death in gas chambers is a hoax, I think it's a fiction. See, in Germany and Canada, now if you expressed that view and did it publicly, I'm not even sure if you can do it privately. Said, no, they want to prosecute you and put you in jail. Here in the United States, that's repugnant to us. Now, it may well be that that's false. But, you know, a lot of people have false beliefs, and we don't lock them up or put them in jail. For instance, the Protestants are not necessarily anti-Catholic, but they don't subscribe to Catholic doctrine. And the Catholics, in turn, they look at that and say, well, that's heresy, and heresy ought to be punished by death. And in the Middle Ages, they put people to death. They called them Protestants, Protestants. They're protesting. And because they're protesting, they're criminals, because they're not going along with our view, our religious viewpoint. So during the Middle Ages, we had a lot of Protestant Reformation, see? And we came to the conclusion that Catholicism isn't the only theological thought on planet Earth. I know that's repugnant to all you Catholics out there, but the rest of us came to that conclusion. I'm one of those. I don't believe that Catholicism is the first, middle, and last word on theology. And about five-sixths of the rest of the world hold that view. So if you Catholics now think that you've got the truth, you may have. I wouldn't argue with you about that, and I'm sure you believe that, but I don't believe it, and I don't subscribe to it. And I don't think I'm anti-Catholic for making that statement, but a lot of times people write me nasty letters. I get a lot of nasty letters. They say, well, you're anti-Christian, you're anti-Catholic, you're anti-Semitic, you're anti-this or that. I dissent from that view. Just because I'm not a Catholic doesn't make me anti-Catholic. Just because I'm not a Republican does not make me anti-Republican. I'm not a communist either. I was for many years. I practiced communism until I was 37. I took a look at it and said, you know, I don't think this is a good practice for me. But it may be a good practice for you. So I would not say that people ought not to practice communism or that communism should be eradicated from the face of the earth. In fact, most of the people of the earth today believe in communism, practice communism, and love it. Why would I want to get in the way of the majority of mankind's happiness and success? Who am I to run around and tell you, all of you communists out there, that you have the wrong political ideology and you need to subscribe to the Gordon ideology? I don't believe that. I've never claimed to be infallible and you ought to follow me. That's somebody else that came up with that infallible argument. I didn't do that. So there's a famous judge. His name was William O. Douglas. And he filed a lot of dissenting opinions in the court. He had a very famous line. He said, we have reached the right conclusion for all of the wrong reasons. We've reached the right conclusion for all of the wrong reasons. I like that. And he would write a dissent and he would say, well, here's why I'm dissenting. The conclusion of the court may be correct, but the reasoning behind it is fallacious. It's full of fallacies. And I want to correct the modality or the methodology that we arrived or that we used to arrive at this conclusion because it's erroneous. Even though in this case we came up with the right conclusion. Sometimes he'd say, this is the wrong conclusion, and I'm going to dissent because it's just plain wrong. Ron Paul, he's a representative here in the United States in Congress. He's called Mr. No. He votes no constantly, especially on economic issues over there in Congress. You know, they'll come up with a stimulus plan. He votes no, and they call him Mr. No. Well, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with him expressing his view and then reporting his view to the rest of us for our consideration? Now, most Americans reject Ron Paul, and they reject his views. So, that means that Ron Paul's in the minority, and the majority of you people out there can express your views, but what's wrong with a minority of people expressing their view? And sometimes they're called dangerous. What's dangerous about Ron Paul's view of hard money versus paper currency? Why is that dangerous? Is it dangerous because other people might believe him and subscribe to his view, so that's dangerous to your view and your agenda? Or is he dangerous because you think he's going to overthrow the government and take away from you your paper money, your checking account, and your credit cards? Do you believe that one representative represents a danger to you and that there's going to be some major change made in the economic system of the nation? Well, what would be wrong with that even if it did come to pass? Because back in 1787, our founding fathers had a unique view of economics, and they subscribed to it and put it into our Constitution. They said, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. They subscribed to it. It was the majority view until 1933. Then the majority view changed, and Franklin Roosevelt took our gold away from us and left us with our paper money that we got from the Federal Reserve back in 1913-14. That's what we have to this day. The majority view today is that paper money is the way we ought to go. I dissent from that view. I dissent. Now, somebody writes me a letter and says, well, you're dangerous. Why am I dangerous? Because I dissent from the majority view. How is that a threat to you or your country or your government or your economics or anything else? What's that got to do with the price of putty? You know, just because somebody disagrees with you doesn't make them your enemy. Just because Larry Beecraft doesn't hold every view that I hold doesn't make him my enemy. And I always thought he was a pretty good guy. I never took offense at his disagreements with me. And then he disagreed with me right to my face on numerous occasions and said, I think that's a crazy argument. Well, okay, he's entitled to his view. He's entitled to his beliefs, isn't he? So when I put his paper into my paperwork, there are two items in here that I disagreed with, but they're out of 26, I agreed with 24. So, you know, from time to time I point out, in fact, I do it in every broadcast, and I say, the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Well, just because the guy that writes the newsletter or the periodical or the book disagrees with me, doesn't mean that he's wrong and that I'm right, or that I'm right and he's wrong. He has a disagreement and he's voicing his opinion. Okay, well, I can respect that. And I think that everybody else ought to. We don't, but I think we ought to. One of our famous old-timey founding fathers said that I disagree with this guy, but I'm going to defend to the death his right to disagree. He didn't say exactly those words, but I think it was Patrick Henry that said that. He said, I'll defend to the death his right to his opinion or to his freedom of speech. So I'm opposed to two. I don't think that it's right to limit people's freedom of speech. Now, here in this country, we came to a conclusion that communists don't have a right to their freedom of speech. We called this McCarthyism. We came to a conclusion back in the early 1950s that communists were bad people and that they were seeking to overthrow the government by force and violence. Well, there is a point there that if you're trying to overthrow the government by force and violence, you might have to limit somebody's right to free speech. If you're inciting people to violence, inciting people to riot, inciting people to break the law, well, there are limits to this thing of free speech. And the courts, and indeed government, and indeed God himself, has placed limits upon your unfettered right, or your belief that you have an unfettered right to free speech. Free speech, just like anything else in life, is a matter of responsibility. You know, somebody has to be responsible for his actions. So if you want to say something, that's fine, but you've got to be responsible for what you say. Now, Justice Scalia was being interviewed on 60 Minutes here not too long ago by Leslie Stahl, and she asked him, she was kind of surprised. She said, now, the Judge Ginsburg on the court disagrees with you quite often, and Judge Scalia nodded his head and said, yeah, she does. And then Leslie Stahl said, but you are on a very friendly personal basis with Judge Ginsburg, and he nodded and he said, yes, I am. And he says, well, how, she asked him, how can you be so friendly and personal with Judge Ginsburg when she disagrees with you all the time? And he said, well, just because she's wrong doesn't mean that we can't sit down and have a discussion together. I like that. You know, just because she's wrong, Justice Ginsburg, on the other hand, would probably sit there and say, well, just because Scalia is wrong doesn't mean we can't have lunch together. I like that. Just because they don't agree on everything doesn't mean that they can't be agreeable on those things that they have a common agreement with or that they have a common interest in. So this thing of freedom of speech, you know, requires some responsibility, and just because somebody disagrees with you doesn't mean that they're disagreeable. And oftentimes people really get upset. Oh, they just they rant and rave and jump up and down, paw the ground, bite the bushes, and really get upset. Well, Larry Beecraft took a position here. He said the manufacturer's certificate of origin argument. And I thought, let's take a look at this argument, because I disagree with him on some, not all. Some of what he says here is true. Some of what he says here isn't true. It's wrong. But just because Larry Beecraft's wrong doesn't mean that I should take his paper and trash it and say that this guy is anti-American and he's unconstitutional and he's some kind of a bad fellow because he doesn't agree with me, or vice versa. So for you students out there that wonder how come I promote people's newsletters and papers and things like that, even though sometimes they say some unkind things about me, I don't say unkind things about other people. I might say, well, here's what this guy believes, here's what this guy said, here's what I'm reading from, and here, so I'm going to read from, here's what Larry Beecraft said. And then when I disagree with it, I'm going to tell you, well, I disagree with that. So let's take a look at freedom of speech. Here's an example of it. During December of 1999, I received some angry email from a female in Colorado who made the argument that those vile lawyers had devised a way to steal the title of cars away from the people by way of the manufacturer's certificate of origin, the MCO. According to her, the MCO had been developed as the way to stealthily obtain ownership of all cars in America by the state, and this scheme was clear proof of some communist plot, and here's part of her argument. Now, remember, this is Larry Beecraft's section 25 called the Manufacturer Certificate of Origin argument. And so he's going to weigh in on this MCO argument. But he's taking a letter that came from a lady in Colorado, and here's what she wrote to Larry Beecraft. She said, "Next, the deceitful lawyers, DBA, the state, coerced these dealers into stealing the real bill of sale, called the Manufacturer Certificate of Origin, and unlawfully converting it into a title, which does not convey lawful ownership of the private car. It's just another little fraud crime that they pull. Now, lying lawyers, DBA, the states, claim ownership of your car, which is why your tags state for official use only. That way, the lying lawyers, DBA, the state, can now regulate, fine for their own personal gain, and take their car whenever they want. Don't just take my words for it. Do your own homework. I did. When we made the final payment on our little Chevy, I called the GM loan company and demanded my manufacturer's certificate of origin. They said, oh, we give you the title. And I said, I don't want any stupid title. I want the true and lawful bill of sale. So they referred me to the dealer. I called the dealer and demanded my true and lawful bill of sale. And I got the same response. I demanded by MCO, and finally the manager of the company admitted to me that the state makes them turn over to them the MCO when the cars come in. And I said, madam, don't you know that is grand theft and unlawful conversion? And her reply was, well, what is scary is that now the federal government wants them, and you don't think you live in a communist government and the lying lawyer club is the primary perverters of this country into communism? That's the end of the quotation. And Beecraft comes back and says, well, according to this woman, when she bought her Chevy, she did not receive the real title to her car, which is the MCO. She contends that the MCO constitutes the title to her car, and that her car is really owned by the state. This is a wild and groundless theory, which many simply believe because they refuse to perform any research. Now, that's the end of Larry Beecraft's statement concerning this lady's email to him. So I'm going to come in and I'm going to weigh in on this manufacturer's certificate of origin. If I was a judge and I had just read that argument, I would say of that lady's statement, I dissent in part and I affirm in part. Some of what she says I agree with and some of what she says I disagree with. I have an opinion about this MCO also, but it isn't exactly the same as this lady. Now, Larry Beecraft is going to come in and he's going to say, well, let me tell you what I think. Let me show you what I have found out. And we'll take a look at what Larry Beecraft found out about the MCO right after this brief interlude while I give you this message. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, it's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or we recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing and recommending are necessarily going to reciprocate. So let's keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about freedom of speech. Freedom of speech. It entails listening to the other guy over there as he disagrees with you, and you don't like what he's saying, you don't like his beliefs, you don't like his position, and you have to stifle yourself and then let him air his views. Oftentimes, when you're watching the McLaughlin group on PBS on Friday night, do you ever notice that those people interrupt each other constantly? It's the only news program that I know, or news or commentary program that I know of that does that. But, you know, somebody will express a view, and then another guy over here, he can't wait until this person finishes what they have to say. So he has to jump in and disagree with them, and then raise his voice and try to drown the other person out, so that he can't complete his thought, can't complete his statement, can't express himself. And that's because of the big eye. I have to get my opinion's more important than yours, so I'm going to yell louder than you. My wife just really takes exception to that. It just grates on her. Now, actually, that's a staged program. See? And those people, there's two conservatives and there's two liberals on there, and all of them agree. You know, their basic disagreements are over the details, not in the basic policy. The conservatives and the liberals are all in favor of the economic policies of the United States, either of the Bush administration or of the Obama administration. They're just opposed to the implementation of the policy. They're all in favor of economic stimulus. They're just opposed to the way it's carried out. Now, there could be another view. Now, Ron Paul comes up with another view. He says, I think this economic stimulus is this horse pucky, and that we ought to let them all go bankrupt, and let's go back to gold and silver coin like we did in 1787. Now, that's his view. But his view is never put out there. Never. There's the mainstream media is controlled. And right away, somebody's going to write me a nasty email, and they'll say, well, you dirty, low-down, no-good, dumb conspiracy theorist. Boys and girls, if it weren't controlled, then somebody out there would raise the issue of gold and silver. The issue of gold and silver is never on the table as a solution to the economic dilemma that the world finds itself in. That's never in the discussion. What's in the discussion is the stimulus program and how much. We're only arguing about, well, is it too much or too little? Everybody's in favor of the stimulus program. I would like to see freedom of speech extended to Ron Paul and Robert Chapman and Franklin Sanders, and then I'd like to have more input. I'd like to see more discussion. And I don't see that on the McLaughlin Group or on Now or Bill Moyers Journal, although Bill Moyers had a guy on there the other day. I was kind of surprised. Now, Moyers is kind of a liberal dingling. And Bill Moyers had this guy on. He's a professor from Kansas City. I think it was University of Missouri. He's an economist. And he said this whole thing is contrived. And Moyers was just absolutely shocked. What do you mean contrived? He said, well, it's all staged. It's all put on. It's as phony as a $3 bill, talking about the stimulus programs and this economic meltdown. I said, well, that's refreshing. Really refreshing. Get a guy on there exercising free speech. Now, Bill Moyers comes out with some pretty good stories once in a while. He's a pretty good journalist. I like Bill Moyers. I watch him just about every Friday night. And David Brancaccio is pretty good. He's another liberal dingling, but, you know, he's got a viewpoint, and he brings his viewpoint, even though it's pretty mainstream. He has some pretty good exposés. Now, well, did you know that this is what's going on over here? And I like that. I appreciate somebody pointing that out to me. That's what freedom of speech is all about. That's why I brought up Larry Becraft here. Larry Becraft now comes back, and he's going to say about this letter from this lady over here. I'm not going to comment on the lady's letter yet. I'm going to wait until we get both sides of this argument out, and then I think I'll weigh in on the story. So now you got the lady's argument. She thinks the MCO, bill of sale, and title are all synonymous terms. And Larry Becraft says, quote, a manufacturer's certificate of origin is a specified document certifying the country of origin of the merchandise required by certain foreign countries for tariff purposes. It sometimes requires the signature of the consul of the country to which it is destined. Our country ships lots of its products internationally, and so does the rest of the world. This document was just simply created by international convention, primarily for tax purposes. As you can see, it is not the title of any object, not even for cars. Federal regulations deal with this matter. For example, in 19 CFR, section 181.11, entitled Certificate of Origin, the following is found. A. In general, a certificate of origin shall be employed to certify that a good being exported either from the United States into Canada or Mexico, or from Canada or Mexico into the United States, qualifies as an originating good for purposes of preferential tariff treatment under the NAFTA. B. Preparation of certificate in the United States. An exporter in the United States who completes and signs a certificate of origin for the purpose set forth in paragraph A of this section shall use Customs Form 434 or such other medium or format as approved by the Canadian or Mexican Customs Administration for that purpose. And where the U.S. exporter is not the producer of the good, that exporter may complete and sign a certificate on the basis of, one, its knowledge of whether the good qualifies as an originating good, or two, its reasonable reliance on the producer's written representation that the good qualifies as an originating good, or three, a completed and signed certificate for the good voluntarily provided to the exporter by the producer. C. Submission of certificates to customs. An exporter in the United States and a producer in the United States who has voluntarily provided a copy of a certificate of origin to that exporter pursuant to paragraph B3 of this section shall provide a copy of the certificate to customs upon request. And D, notification of errors in certificate. An exporter or producer in the United States who has completed and signed a certificate of origin and who has reason to believe that the certificate contains information that is not correct shall, within 30 calendar days after the date of discovery of the error, notify in writing all persons to whom the certificate was given by the exporter or producer of any change that would affect the accuracy or validity of the certificate. Now there's the statutes. Cars are big exports for this country, and the manufacturers deal with certificates of origin every day. In fact, NAFTA has provisions regarding such certificates at Article 501, which may be viewed here. So if you were on Larry B. Kraft's website, you could view that NAFTA article. Now, because car manufacturers provide such certificates for international trade, the states also demand them. In Colorado, the following statute makes a clear distinction between car titles and MCOs, MCO being the manufacturer's certificate of origin. In the Colorado Revised Statute 42-6-113, new vehicles, bill of sale, and certificate of title. Upon the sale or transfer by a dealer of a new motor vehicle, such dealer shall, upon the delivery thereof, make, execute, and deliver unto the purchaser or transferee a good and sufficient bill of sale, therefore, together with the manufacturer's certificate of origin. Said bill of sale shall be affirmed by a statement signed by such dealer, shall contain or be accompanied by a written declaration that it is made under the penalties of perjury in the second degree as defined in section 18-8-503 of the Colorado Revised Statutes, and shall be in such form as the director may prescribe, and shall contain, in addition to other information which the director may, by rule or regulation from time to time, require, and make, and the model of the motor vehicle so sold or transferred, the identification number placed upon the vehicle by the manufacturer for identification purposes, the manufacturer's suggested retail price, and the date of the sale or transfer thereof, together with a description of any mortgage thereon given to secure the purchase price or any part thereof, upon presentation of such a bill of sale to the director or one of the director's authorized agents, a new certificate of title for the vehicle therein described shall be issued and disposition thereof made as in other cases. The transfer of a motor vehicle which has been used by a dealer for the purpose of demonstration to prospective customers, if such motor vehicle is a new vehicle as defined in section 42-6-1028, shall be made in accordance with the provisions of this section. Now there's the statute. Now I'd like to note here that that statute does not even mention the MCO. It mentions the title, mentions the bill of sale, but not the MCO. Okay, manufacturer certificate of origin. All right, so let's listen to B. Kraft. He says, thus, under Colorado law, it is plain that a manufacturer's certificate of origin is different from the title to a car as well as the bill of sale for the same. Now, I would concur with that. In fact, I wrote down these three terms here. We have a bill of sale, we have a manufacturer's certificate of origin, and we have a title, three documents. Those are real pieces of paper. And you'll see a piece of paper, and it says bill of sale. That's one piece of paper. And then you'll have a manufacturer's certificate of origin. That's another piece of paper. And then you'll have a title. That's a third piece of paper. It's three different kinds of paper here, three different papers. These three different papers are not synonymous. And this lady, now remember, when she wrote her letter to Larry B. Kraft, she evidently thought that these three things were synonymous terms. Now, I have a difference of opinion with this lady, and so does Larry B. Kraft. And I have a difference of opinion with Larry B. Kraft concerning his take on the MCO also. But I'll come to my opinion a little later on. And then I'll support my opinion with, here's my experience, and here's what my experience in the courts produced, and here's what I saw. And I'll weigh in on the subject a little later in the program. Here's my point. Larry B. Kraft has a point of view. And then he expresses his point of view in his written treatise I'm going to call it paragraph. It's actually his number 25. It's not a paragraph. It's many paragraphs. But in his number 25, the 25th subject matter that he brought up, he expresses his opinion. Now, his opinion may be true. It may be false, or it may be a combination of the two. In the same way that my opinion may be true, it may be false, or a combination of the two. And this lady has an opinion. And she's pretty irate. Remember in the tone of her letter, she's calling the lawyers names. Well, you know, kind of. She's disparagingly. Talking about the lawyers, you know, who've conspired to steal the people's titles to their cars by taking the MCO. Now, it could well be that this lady's been listening to me. I don't have, you know, much good to say about the government taking your MCO, the manufacturer's certificate of origin. And I've expressed my opinion. And it may be that this lady has formed her opinion based upon my opinion, and maybe my opinion and somebody else's opinion. Oftentimes, we form our opinions based upon the input from one, two, three, or five other people. And then when we're asked about it, we will cite one of those one, two, three, or five people. And then he gets the credit or the blame for making this entire opinion when in reality he only had a small input to the opinion. I've got an opinion, and I make my opinion known in my class. My student then takes that opinion and puts it together with the opinion that he got from somebody else and maybe two or three other people, and he comes up with an independent student opinion. But when you ask him, he may say, well, I learned that at George Gordon School, when in fact he learned 20% of it at the George Gordon School, but 80% of his opinion doesn't have anything to do with me or what he learned here. So let's understand that, you know, free speech has responsibility attached to it. And I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding that goes on among teachers and observers and students concerning this thing of free speech. I mean, everybody's entitled to their opinion. But are you entitled to represent your opinion as coming from George Gordon when, in fact, only 20% of it came from George Gordon? And 80% of it came from some other source. So when you're ascribing your opinion, it's one thing to say, well, my opinion is. Well, where did you get your opinion? Well, I got it from George Gordon, when, in fact, no, you didn't. No, you didn't. That's not what I believe. That's not what I teach. That's not what I'm trying to get across to you. But I get all the credit or all the blame. You know, the same thing happens with the Pope, you know. If a Catholic expresses an opinion and we say, well, where did you get that? Well, that's church doctrine. That's church teaching. Now, that Catholic may believe that that is church doctrine or that it is church teaching when, in fact, it is not. Or it may be church doctrine or church teaching in part. Or it may be your local priest's opinion in part. I mean, there's a controversy going on right now. There's a bishop, I believe he is. And he expressed the opinion that he did not believe that the Nazi Holocaust, that is the gassing of Jews, occurred in the way that it's been transcribed, you know, by certain groups. And the Pope weighed in on it. And he said, oh, no, that doesn't represent Catholic policy or teaching or doctrine or whatever. Then he said to this bishop, he said, now recant. Take that back. Well, excuse me, boys and girls, but wait a minute. Hang on a second here. Let's just take a subject. Let's suppose that the subject is abortion. Now, you have an opinion concerning abortion, don't you? You're either for it or against it, or maybe you're neutral, then you're not for it or against it. And so, you've got your opinion. Now, let's just come to you and say, wait a minute, that's wrong. Now change your opinion. Change your belief, too, and let me dictate to you. From now on, you're going to be an abortionist, and you're going to espouse the straight abortion line. Do you think that you could just switch on and switch off your beliefs because I told you to? You know, somebody's belief concerning something isn't something that you just switch on and switch off like the lights in a room by flipping the switch. That's nonsense. You have an opinion, and that opinion has been developed over a long period of time. Your opinion may be true. It may be accurate. It may be correct. Or it may be false. It may be incorrect. Or it may be a combination of the two. It may have some true facts. It may be partially correct, and it may be partially in error. Has anybody ever thought of that? So then, in this thing called free speech, shouldn't we take into consideration that this opinion being expressed here by Larry Beecraft, it may be 100% true. And if it is, then this lady's opinion is 100% in error. Now, I'm going to weigh in on it, and I'm going to disagree with both the lady and Larry Beecraft. I'm going to come up with a totally different take. I'm going to say, wait a minute, Beecraft is right about 1, 2, and 3, but he's wrong about 4, 5, and 6. And I'm going to say this lady is correct in her basic premise, but she's incorrect about 1, 2, and 6. And I'm going to come on the scene and say, I believe that the real issue is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and here's the way it lays out. Now, somebody else can come into the discussion and say, Gordon is crazy. Or he could say, well, Gordon's partially correct, but he's in error on 2, 3, and 4. But he's right about 1, 2, and 6. I mean, come on, guys. That's what freedom of speech is all about. It's an opportunity for everybody to put their input in. And then it may influence your output. Your conclusion at the end of this dialogue may be something different than it was when we went into it. Now, oftentimes you've heard me say, I'm not here to convince you that I'm right. I tell my students when they walk in the door, now listen, boys and girls, I have my opinions and my beliefs, and here it is, and I put it in writing, and here's the book, and here's my CDs, and now you're in class, and I'm going to tell you how this works. And you may disagree with me. And then it's all right. It won't be the first time that you've been in error, and it won't be the last. Just like Judge Scalia, it isn't the first time that Ruth Bader Ginsburg has been wrong, and she's wrong. And let me tell you why. Now, if you think I'm wrong, why don't you present your evidence? Maybe you could persuade me that you are correct and that I am in error. I have made a mistake once before in my life, and I was corrected. And when I'm corrected, I come back and say, well, boy, I got tuned up in no uncertain terms. I believed A, B, and C, and I found out that the truth was Z, Y, X, and so therefore, I'm going to alter my opinion. That A, B, C thing, I'm going to reject because that's not true. I thought it was true. See, I practiced communism until I was 37. Hell, I thought that was a pretty good program. I came to the conclusion, hey, this communism isn't as good as I thought it was. And so I made a change. After all, that's what freedom of speech is all about. It creates a change in your viewpoint. But it isn't something that you can just switch on and switch off because somebody raises his voice and yells louder than somebody else. It's done by persuasion. It's done by reason, logic, and common sense. It's done by freedom of speech. Freedom of speech. That's what changes opinions. That's what gives us the truth versus the error. If everybody is stifled and no one can speak, if we're going to have this hate crime legislation, then the ultimate issue of, well, did the Germans kill those people with gas, or did they kill those people by some other means? I mean, could it be that Hitler killed all of those people that everybody believes that he killed, but that he didn't kill all of them with gas, or that he killed none of them with gas, or that he killed them in some third form? I mean, why don't we take a look at what we agree with, what we disagree with, and what we're in error on, and put it all together, and maybe we could arrive at a consensus. Maybe we could arrive at the truth without all of the acrimony and without all of the yelling and the screaming and you did and you didn't and she did and he didn't or she said, he said. I'm out of time here, kids. We're going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you've been listening to the Law Hour and editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by pre-arrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.